Hello and welcome back to Growth Coaching International's Coaching in Education podcast. I'm your host, Richard Reid, and you're joining us for another episode in our Instructional Coaching Done Well mini-series. In a previous episode, we explored what great instructional coaching looks like with Dr. Jim Knight and Chris Munro. In this episode, we're shifting our focus to coaches as leaders, because great coaching isn't just about supporting others, it's about how we lead ourselves and those around us. To help us unpack this, I'm delighted to be joined once again by Dr. Jim Knight and Chris Munro, and I extend that warm welcome to one of our GCI directors, Dan Steele. In this episode, we'll be diving into some key ideas, including how we navigate the challenges of leadership, particularly when we get stuck and ego gets in the way, why self-care is an essential leadership skill, and how great coaches balance ambition with humility. We'll also explore how coaches create alignment, make great decisions, and clarify their purpose. So let's get started with leading ourselves. Jim, I'll come to you first. Can you share with us a little bit about what you mean by getting stuck as leaders and the challenge of ego?
Yeah, I think that the challenge of ego is that it's destructive in so many different ways. You know, I've read a lot about trust because I wrote a section on trust for Better Conversations. And again and again and again, what erodes trust is self-interest, and what increases the likelihood of trust is benevolence. And so if it's all about me, it's less likely that people will want to embrace what we have to share. But the other thing is, if ego is what drives you, an absence of humility, it's going to interfere with your capacity to learn. I wrote an article called The Learning Zone, or Escape from the Learning Zone. And in that article, I talked about how if you want to be a learner, you have to sort of approach learning opportunities from a place of humility. We should actually be reading people who have different opinions than ours and really trying to hear it. And when someone comes to us with a criticism or a suggestion, instead of being defensive and explaining it away and blaming them, we should be open to hearing what they have to say. And so humility can block our capacity to be successful, because it's going to erode trust. We'll be less successful that way. It's also going to get in the way of the opportunity to learn. And I think when it comes to the role of being a leader, that you don't mobilize people by having them follow you and build your ego up. You mobilize them by having them embrace a vision that's powerful. I mean, life is short. Why shouldn't you be working on something that's good for society as opposed to good for yourself? So lots and lots of ways. And it's not to say that you should walk around with your, you know, head between your knees and heartbroken. But humility also doesn't mean that I'm not going to speak up and say what I need to say. It doesn't mean I'm giving up. I'm lacking efficaciousness. Humility just means I'm open to hearing another person's perspective. You know, when I wrote about this a while back in a column about humility, I started off with this quote from another author. And he told his friend, yeah, I'm writing a book about humility. And his friend said, well, you've got objective distance from the issue. And there is a sense in which I feel funny talking about humility. Like, I'm such a humble guy. I think it's a challenge always to recognize that pride is waiting around the door and ready to devour us. And if we give into it, we're gonna limit our ability to learn, to lead, to motivate other people, and to foster trust. So I think it's a critical thing. But I want to stress again, humility doesn't mean we don't say what has to be said. Humility doesn't mean we let people walk all over us. Humility just means, I think really what humility means is we have a fairly realistic picture of reality, that we succeed because of others, not just because of ourselves, and that there's a lot to learn.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And I'm going to be so bold here, Jim, as to quote a local author over here in Northern Ireland, C.S. Lewis, when you think about humility. And he says, humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. So when it comes to that, you know, leadership and coaching, I think that's a really healthy way of looking at the whole term humility. So that's been really helpful, Jim. Thanks for sharing your thoughts on that one. Dan, I'd love to bring you into the conversation at this point and ask you to share some thoughts on practicing self-care. What does that look like when it's done well?
It's
That's a very big word, isn't it? The self-care. I think when I was thinking about this from my own perspective of seeing this in action with instructional coaches in schools, also being an instructional coach myself, my first thought was similar to, I think, Simon Sinek talks in some recent writing about the infinite game. Like, there's certain things where you can never win the game. Like, we never win education. It's always emerging. It's always innovating. It's always changing. So I think the thing when I was first an instructional coach, I thought, right, there was some end point, but it never ends at any point. And I tried to go really, really big. So I guess my first thought around that was trying to break it down into small parts. Like, what are your leading indicators? What are your small signs of success first of all? Like, what do you see for yourself? Are your wins, your quick wins, your longer term wins? Getting really clear on those indicators of success. Because otherwise, if we talk about instructional coaching or leading change, that can seem really big and be quite daunting. And that can be really hard too. So it also made me think about Dr. Kristen Neff's work around self-compassion, which one of the first things she talks about is reminding yourself that you're not in this alone, so that there's other people that are going through this change and this struggle too. But something that I heard that worked really well was another instructional coach that I worked with. And they said the question that they used to ask themselves was, what would I say to my best friend if they were talking about the struggles, the challenges, the leading the change, the dealing with resistance, the wanting to make improvements quicker than they are? And the question they started asking themselves was, well, what would I say if this was my best friend? And that suddenly changed the voice they were having, instead of thinking, oh, we're not doing enough cycles, or I'm not seeing enough coaches, I'm not doing enough. And suddenly that changed when they started trying to talk to themselves as if they were their own best friend.
I think that's helpful. And for a lot of our listeners, particularly those folks, I think, who are new to instructional coaching, those are sort of things that, you know, needs to be front and center in their thinking when it comes to the whole idea of self-compassion and health. Dan, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on that one. I want to move into the whole area of leading others. And Chris, I'm going to come across to you. Could you share us maybe a few thoughts around the whole idea of balance ambition with humility?
First thing to say is it's a constant balance, isn't it? Because most of us end up in instructional coaching or leading professional learning or middle leadership roles because we care deeply about, I was going to say we care deeply about change. I don't think I would have said that when I was actually doing it. I think I'd actually rather have less change. But I think we care deeply about supporting others to make improvements in the practice for students. And I often say, not because what we're seeing happening now is hopeless, not from a deficit point of view, but that can be a really challenging thing to do. So that ambition for change or ambition for movement or progress, there's other words we can put in there, in the interests of student and educator flourishing. I think that one is hand in hand, you know, that leading yourself and self-compassion and so on is about ensuring you're at your best in order to be of best service to those around you. That applies to the teachers too. You know, a teacher who isn't in a good place, doesn't feel that sense of competence and self-efficacy and so on, is not in the best place to serve the learning and well-being of the children in their charge. So I think one goes hand in hand. But, and I sometimes see this in new instructional coaches more, they're so keen to be helpful that helpfulness overruns into, I've got so much to offer, I've got so much to help, I can see all the need here. And then there's a frustration of the people that need me aren't the ones who are saying, come in and help me, Richard. You know, they're not opening the doors. The doors are closing as I go down the corridor. And that so overplaying that ambition can result in you being too pushy, oversharing, having too much, overwhelming and so on. And it's most often coming from a good place. Sometimes you hear lines of but the kids don't have time to wait. Change needs to happen in Richard's class right now. You know, and you've got to be able to say, well, how's that going to work out for you? If that's the way, you know, we go back to the partnership principles, we go back to how you show up as a coach. That sounds like you really want to go in there and just tell them what needs to change in their class and hope that'll do it. How's that working out for you? You know, so people who really get what it means to be an instructional coach and partner have to really work, because we all have that in us as humans, really work to balance their own ambition, their own knowledge, their own voice, their own contribution to the conversation with showing up in ways that demonstrate humility. And humility is a word that needs a wee bit of unpacking as well. That it as you said, it doesn't mean thinking less of yourself. It doesn't mean diminishing what I know and saying, oh, who am I? I know. They know you're a coach, so therefore they expect you to know something. You know, as Jim would say, if I show up and I've got nothing for you, well, I'm not a very good instructional coach, am I? But it's knowing how and when. The word I keep coming to is discernment. Noticing and then discerning what my next move is. And sometimes my next move is to say, well, there's a few things that could work here. That provisional tentative language is one way of demonstrating humility. The way we listen, the way we choose to elevate and amplify their voice before ours demonstrates humility. It puts them more in the driving seat. So there are subtle things I think we do. And when we do more of that, we're actually, at the same time, dialing down our own voice and our own, what Michael Bungay Stannier would call it, advice monster on our shoulder that we've all got as humans. Just tell them, I can add value here, all that stuff. So I think it's a constant struggle. That makes it sound like it's a battle. If it's a battle, then it's going to get in the way of how you're showing up in the conversation. You won't be present. But I think for leaders and for coaches, it's that balance of how much of me is needed right now. And when I'm saying how much of me, how much of my knowledge, my shaping the conversation, my supporting their thinking. And I think it's also part of ambition is showing up in a way that provides supportive challenge for that person. You're not just there. And Jim, in the book, you talk about a couple of examples. The coach who goes kind of easy and says, they'll come to me when they're ready. Didn't make much impact because nobody saw the need. And then the one who was overambitious maybe and really wanted to see that change and was pushy and so on, and people turned away. And then the ones that are successful are the ones who balance that, who nudge enough, words like nudge and supportive challenge rather than direct challenge. You need to change, you need to do that differently. So you do that in the way you use data, you do that in the way you partner with people, you come alongside them, you shine light on things, you help them see reality. And so for me, I think it boils down to coaches understanding that being helpful is not just about what you know. And sometimes that's the way we see it. As humans, we have that advice-giving tendency. My way of being helpful in this conversation is to share what I know. And so when you start to rein that in and see other ways of helping that person think and make progress, you start to strike that balance between ambition and humility, I think.
And I think a key word there, and you've gone back to that a number of times, Chris, is the word balance. And I would imagine, you know, if I'm picking you up properly here, is yes, it is ongoing for all coaches. This is an ongoing development. So I would imagine there's an element of reflection in there. You know, as I develop as a coach, I need to have that element of reflective practice in what I do. And I'm asking for people for their feedback. You know, how is this landing with you? And I think, you know, you're right about stretching people, you know, and getting that balance where you want to, you know, that idea of ambition for movement. I think that's really, really helpful. You're challenging people, but with high support at the same time. And the two are coming hand in hand.
And, you know, you've just reminded me of one of my favourite quotes. There's a bit, I think it's at the start of High Impact Instruction, where we talk about personal bests, or Jim talks about personal bests. And that phrase has always stuck with me, that this is about helping people strive for their personal best, not because what they're doing now is rubbish, but because the work is so complex and ever-changing, as Dan said, that as professionals, we need to be doing that. We should be doing that. There's a moral imperative to be doing that. But it's not from that deficit standpoint. It's from even better, you know? And I think that's part of what's going on when you're balancing those two. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you think about that phrase, even better, I'm going to come across to you, Jim. Can you share with us, and I love this phrase, about being a multiplier? How does that fit in with leading others?
Yeah. In terms of being better, there's a Buddhist phrase, I probably don't have it quite right. Well, it probably wasn't written in English anyway, so this is my translation. But the phrase is something like, you're perfect in everything about you, in every way, and everything about you is perfect. and you can get better. And that's kind of the idea. I think, yes, you know, you should feel validated. Look at the things you're accomplishing. But another Buddhist phrase, after you climb the mountain, keep climbing. Not that I know a whole lot about Buddhism. I learned it all from Jack Kerouac, what little I know. But at any rate, but yeah, I think that's it. But the term multiplier is one that comes from Liz Wiseman, who has written a couple of books, one of them for education, about the concept of a multiplier. She worked at Oracle. And she said the people she worked with, as she studied leaders, that there were some leaders who were highly successful, some who weren't that successful. And she said there are some people she called multipliers that help you feel more capable, smarter, more efficacious, more confident, and other people who made you feel less efficacious, less confident, and less intelligent. And she wanted to figure out what the differences are. Now, when I do this in workshops, I ask people, okay, do you understand the concept of multiplier or diminisher? Everybody's yes. We work with people who made us feel less intelligent. So what are their characteristics? And they describe things like the multipliers are good listeners. They give credit to other people. They challenge people. They put them in challenging situations. They're the last ones to speak up in situations. They encourage others to speak. Diminishers, they have really thin skin. They blame others. They don't take responsibility. They take all the credit. And so they're pretty quick to list off, this is a diminisher and this is a multiplier. But the other part of it is, as Liz Wiseman says, is there are what she calls accidental diminishers. And that's where you diminish people unintentionally. Your heart is to encourage, but actually your actions make things worse, not better. So she talks about, for example, she calls it the optimist, but we would call it maybe toxic positivity. Where I don't really hear you, I don't really see you, I don't really acknowledge what you're going for. I just sort of say, put on a happy face and let's go forward. Don't be so negative. Well, I think if you really see the other person as a real person, then you shouldn't have toxic positivity. You should really see them. You can diminish other people by having all the ideas and just coming in. Here's another thing, and here's another thing, and here's another thing, and diminishing what people do. You can diminish people, and I, as a special ed teacher, this is one that I had to struggle with, by solving other people's problems for them, by being a rescuer, going in there. If I keep helping this person succeed without helping them develop their own capacities to succeed, I'm actually making things worse, not better, because they depend on me for success. It's great that they can come to me and say, hey, I passed. Thank you so much. I couldn't have done it without you. But actually, I want you to learn how to do it without you. And if I'm a rescuer, I diminish you. And just being someone whose pace doesn't match the person you're dealing with. We're pushing so hard for change that it could wear people out. There's other things she says too, but that concept of being a multiplier diminisher, it's one of those things that I like a lot in terms of thinking about what it is to be a leader, to ask myself, are my actions really helping this person be more, be better, or are my actions actually diminishing their capacities?
I think it's just a very healthy thing from a coach's point of view to be asking him or herself, you know, where have I been a multiplier today? You know, looking back over my practice, my conversations, were there occasions where I was conscious, you know, of having that multiplying effect? And again, that comes back to the idea of, you know, being a reflective practitioner is key to instructional coaching done well, I would imagine. Dan, can I bring you into the conversation again? I would love to hear your thoughts on the term creating alignment within instructional coaching.
Well, I mean, look, we've got, as coaches, we love to really dig into what does that word actually mean? What does that look like? Tell me more about that. So I guess when I was thinking about creating alignment, and for me, there was quite a few things thinking of this, but I guess there's three that I'll really talk to. And I guess if we're thinking of coaching in alignment or creating alignment, there's a really clear understanding of what coaching is and what it isn't within schools. So first of all, you know, I think back to in those early stages when people are establishing or setting up instructional coaching, getting clear on what it is, what it isn't. Sometimes we can have those cultures where it can feel like it's a bit more of a compliance approach versus that sort of growth and development approach, or that, you know, when we know the research shows such a highly effective professional development strategy that you can utilize, it can be tailored for everyone. So I think getting really clear on what coaching is and then also what it isn't, and spending time with people around that. And then within the actual interaction, I guess, as a coach, is we start to talk about the partnership principles, and we talk about these as a theory, as an idea, but then it's making sure that we're actually living those out in the conversations, in the moment with the person. So particularly equality. And I know Jim and Chris, you both just mentioned the word previously about humility. Like when you're coaching someone, it's a perfect opportunity to live it out and model it and be in alignment with the person. Give them the power. You don't need to be the one doing all the talking. And yes, we've got expertise by being an instructional coach. Underneath that says that we've got expertise and strategic knowledge, but it's the humility to know when that's needed to be brought in, when it's not. We might be experts in certain aspects, but the person is an expert in their world. They're an expert of those kids on a Friday afternoon and what could potentially work or not work or that setting. So I think for me, it's really that idea of when we're talking about the alignment that we're actually living out those partnership principles, especially equality. And then the third one that I think is probably connects to the work that Christian Van Nieuwenberg and Helen Gormley did around coaching cultures. So that idea of, I was thinking about, and Jim, you might have different thoughts and Chris, different thoughts around this, but I was thinking about part of really successful coaching cultures, we get really great alignment to strategic priorities. So it's not an extra, it's built in. So I guess for me, I was thinking about there's an alignment. The coach brings this alignment to what the schools or the context strategic priorities are alongside the needs of the teacher. So almost like that freedom within form. So the coach brings that sort of expertise, but again, they've got the humility to know when they bring that in and out within the conversation while always treating, being of service to the person that's there with them, knowing that they're the expert of their world, their class, and their life. You know, they've got all that experience that they can tap into.
Well, I'll just add that for me, it's pretty simple. When I'm coaching, I want the teacher to set a goal they really want to go after. And then I want to support them in that goal. And so alignment is when they're clear on where they're going to go. I got the concept from Miller and Rolnick's motivational interviewing. And they said, you know, you can have a wrestling match or you can dance together. And alignment is where the two people are in synchronicity working together because the person knows what they want to accomplish and I'm trying to help them achieve it. So I think it's pretty similar to what you said, but for me, it starts with the goal of the person. And Miller and Rolnick would say the concept of resistance doesn't exist because if I'm really coaching effectively, they're talking about therapy, but if I'm really coaching effectively, I shouldn't be trying to get them to do my thing. So resistance shouldn't be possible. What I should be doing is creating the conditions for them to pick the thing they really want to go after and then support it. That's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, no, you're right, Jim. And it is similar to what Dan has said, because you talk about alignment there. And Dan, you mentioned the idea of, you know, bringing into alignment with, you know, the school's priorities. And I'm thinking here in Northern Ireland with our school development planning hat on, you know, coaching needs to come in to, in many ways, enhance that. You know, it's threaded in to enhance what we do day in, day out in our school, which is ultimately, you know, improve the outcomes for the young people that are coming in through the door in the morning time. And I think that alignment is really, really important. And love that phrase. And I suppose, you know, as coaches who are listening, wouldn't it be interesting to ask yourself during those coaching conversations, are we dancing or are we wrestling here? I think that's a lovely way of thinking about alignment. You know, and I'm not a great dancer, Jim, I'll have to be honest. But, you know, the idea in my head of that conversation, and Dan, you alluded to this, you know, where you're just ear in alignment with the other person, I think that's been really, really helpful. Jim, when it comes to making good decisions, I'm thinking about leading others within instructional coaching. What do we mean by making good decisions?
Well, I want to say one more thing about alignment first, which is I see it. Alignment is not the teacher doing what the system's decided they need to do. Alignment is about the teacher identifying what they want to do and then the system helping them pursue it. And what they want to do needs to be a goal that will have an unmistakably positive impact on kids. So I don't think we move things forward by having teachers do what they're told. We've got decades of trying to do it. It doesn't really work because teachers aren't skilled unskilled laborers. They're professionals. That doesn't mean, though, you shouldn't have a pedagogical framework or a set of practices. I think having that kind of breadth of knowledge across the system, widespread understanding around our foci could be really helpful. It's just that what translates that big vision into practice is saying, okay, we have this, let's say it's the Victorian
high impact teaching strategies, and we're kind of using this. If everybody knows about that, then the coach can say, which of these strategies can we use to address your biggest issue? So you can bring the two together, a global picture and that small thing. But I just want to be clear, to me at least, alignment is not telling teachers what to do and having them do it. Alignment is starting with the change of kids and moving back from that, which means if you're going to implement that, you probably need to be a good decision maker. So let's talk about decision making. So I've read pretty widely in decision making when I wrote about this. I unfortunately had to cut out a lot of the work I did, but it really comes down to Daniel Kahneman's idea that it's a lot of people understand is thinking fast and thinking slow. And so let's say I'm driving in my car and a car pulls out right in front of me. And in a flash, I have to turn my steering wheel to avoid that car. It misses the light. And that's thinking fast. I have to react in the moment. I have to decide what I'm going to do. I don't have time to plan and weigh my options and so forth. I have to deal with it and deal with it quickly. The section option thinking slow is, what if I don't get out of the way of the car, we have an accident? Thinking slow is saying, should I sue this person for the way they drove? And in professional learning and life, we're going to have moments where we have to think fast. We have to have moments where we have to think slow. So for coaches, there's a lot of thinking fast in the midst of a coaching conversation. I've had the pleasure of watching Chris do lots of coaching conversations. His brain is clicking all the time, and he's fully present, but at the same time, he knows he's going to have to make an adjustment. He's going to ask a different kind of question, and that's thinking fast. I have to, in the moment, I have to make this decision. So what I say in writing about this is, it's important to have in your mind some mantras to help you make your decision, or mantras or principles or precepts or whatever you want to call them. So for example, Christian Van Norberg's goal is, it's not about me. And so when he's trying to figure out what the next step is in coaching, he's trying to make a decision, he'll go, it's not about me. So what do I do to help this person flourish? My question is, who's making the decision here? Michael Bungay Stanier's mantra is, be curious just a little bit longer. Your mantra or a set of mantras could be something different, but having some kind of heuristic or rule of thumb, rule in your mind to help you make a decision. That's how you deal with the quick decisions, because in every situation, Christian's going to say, oh, what's best for the person I'm coaching, not what's best for me. And that's going to help him make good decisions. When you're thinking slow, it's kind of what we ordinarily do. We analyze the situation, and we look at it, and we find some way of sorting it out. So gathering a lot of information up front to make a decision is helpful. That looking for more than one perspective, I'm going to buy a car, if I can find out all the different dealerships around me, what they sell the car for, it's really quite helpful. In negotiation, they talk about the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. What are my other options before I come into this negotiation? Then once I've gathered all that information, I have to kind of sort of sift through it and say, what are redundancies here? What are things I wouldn't consider? Get down to the nub of what are my choices. And then I think it's really important to say, well, in this situation, what matters most? So sometimes when we're with teams and we're trying to decide which option we're going to do, we simply narrow it down to two simple things. What's going to be most powerful and what's going to be easiest? And we look for the thing that'll be easiest and most powerful is the thing we're going to do. You could have richer criteria, but that's usually a quick way of processing it. When I was a full-time researcher at the University of Kansas, I'd worked for decades with my colleagues, and Don Deschler. I respect him so much, we named our one award we've got in our organization named after Don Deschler. But I was trying to decide, should I stay at the university or should I leave and go on my own? So I kept having these conversations and I was wrestling around with what should I do, considered all the options. And then I was reading Heath and Heath's book, Switch, and they said, well, what are the values that really matter? So I said, well, it really matters that I do what's best for my family. It really matters that I do what's best for the world, make the most positive impact. Next is I want to honor the people I work with. And last thing is I want to have fun. I want to do things I actually enjoy. And those four things, once I got clear on it, well, family comes first, then making an impact, then honoring my colleagues and enjoying my work. Once I got clear on those criteria, the decision was quick.
I could make it really quickly because I thought it through. But it took me a while to think it through, to think through all the possibilities. So the key thing I'd say is thinking slow is a traditional model, but the more perspectives you can get really clear on what matters so you have criteria to help you process it. Thinking fast to know what your principles are or your mantras. What are the heuristics I'll use to sort through this whole thing? And those are the ways I think you can make a big difference. And the last thing I'll say, and a lot of people, I read a lot about decision-making, is people rush really important decisions in their life, like, should I buy this house? Should I change my job? Should I marry this person? Some of the most important decisions they'll have, they'll change their life they make without even thinking. And so I'd say the last thing I'd say is getting clear on how to make decisions, then making good decisions when they matter is really, really, really important.
Fantastic. And that's just a lovely segue in about getting clear and clarity. Chris, for the last point that I want to raise is around clarifying your purpose and ultimately knowing what great leadership is. What are your thoughts on that?
Whew, you left the biggest one for last. Clarifying your purpose. You know, I think that, and I make so many links here. I love the way this conversation has just flown from one to the other. So this is back to the big picture thing again. You know, if I don't have a clear sense of what my purpose is as an instructional coach, as a leader, about what's really driving me, and it links to even things like self-determination theory, Jim, you know, in terms of people need to be really thriving in their role, they need a deep sense of purpose. So we could talk about moral purpose, you know, and it's about the students. It's not about me. You know, it's not about the practices. It's about the student learning and well-being and so on. It's about the educators around me flourishing and thriving in their role. And we all have our own stories of what drove us to the roles that we ended up in at different stages. And we have the privilege of supporting and coaching and leading others who have their own aspirations and things. And right underneath that, sometimes you need to help people dig into what is it that's really driving you here? What do you see your purpose as? And sometimes there's a barrier there or an obstacle, a speed bump, being gradually more professional, aren't I? That they hit because their sense of what, especially for instructional coaches, their sense of purpose and what they're about isn't aligned. Let's use that word again. Or there's a mismatch between that and what their line manager or leaders or system leaders has said they have to do. Jim, we've talked and written in this in the past about call off the fidelity police, one of my favourite blog posts in Radical Learners, because the system is kind of administering them as the police of the strategies and you will do it this way. Whereas that wasn't really why they got into instructional coaching. The driving purpose underneath that was I want to support educators to develop better outcomes for students. And so helping people really tap into that and I'd suggest sometimes that's tricky to do on your own as a reflective exercise. A coach can really help you really do that, and it's maybe a more facilitative thing. So I think that's really important. But the other wider side to that is there then a shared purpose? You know, does your line manager, does the system or the school within which you operate share that view of you know, what you're about and what you're there to do? And it links to some of the other things we've said about in the definitive guide about system support. I think great leadership, you know, Jim, you said it in the book, you know, the, when you Google, you know, what's great leadership and the number of hits you get, it's a perennial thing. We've thrown around terms in schools like instructional leadership and so on, and that's still a bit fuzzy as well. But I think in terms of coaches as leaders, and even coach-like leaders, which is a real area of interest of mine, I think there are indicators of what strong leadership looks like there. One of them we've actually illustrated all the way through this conversation. There's more use of the word we than I when strong leadership is present. And certainly the way a coach operates and the way a coach-like leader operates, it's about we. And we speaks to alignment. It speaks to the other kind of alignment that you were talking about, Jim, as well. It speaks to a shared ambition and collective or striving for collective efficacy as well. And I think, as we've said, coaches balance ambition with responsiveness. I think highly effective leaders balance responsiveness with ambition. And they hold that ambition and make that ambition clear. And that's that kind of shared purpose as well. And I think if I bring it right back, the last thing I would say is back to what the coaches do, and I think you alluded to this earlier, Jim, I think coaches, instructional coaches, when it's working well, when it's well understood, when they're supported and there's advocacy and there's permission and all the conditions are there, they are real culture shapers. We fleetingly mentioned the word culture. They shape culture. And you want them to be doing that knowingly, consciously, and with license and permission and support from the other leadership in the school. I know in my early days, I felt sometimes I was shaping culture from the middle out and pushing, and it kind of influenced up the way. The ideal scenario is you've already got that endorsement and support and clarity of understanding above as well. So in that big ramble, I'm not sure I've answered the question, what is leadership? Either I've probably added to the complexity, but I think there are things that really good instructional coaches do, the kind of language, the kinds of things that they are, the tensions that they are mitigating and balancing, that are actually, there are very strong parallels between that and what effective school leadership would look like anyway. And that's why we talk about more coach-like leaders. That those dispositions, how they see others, how they see their role in interaction with others, and how they discern when it needs more of them, less of them, when it is an I think conversation versus a we are moving in this together conversation, it all boils down to conversations for me. We lead and influence through conversation. And so a coach-like way of leading is being more intentional and discerning on how we operate in those, in that myriad of conversations through which we lead.
That's been really, really helpful on that final point. And again, gentlemen, you know, genuinely a huge thanks to all three of you for, and I mean, this has been a big thing for me, bringing real clarity to the idea of coaches as leaders. And as we've discussed today, instructional coaching is about more than just supporting others. It starts with how we lead ourselves. Whether it's managing ego, practicing self-care, clarifying our purpose, these are all essential aspects of being an effective instructional coach. Again, as I said in the previous episode, if our listeners, if you've enjoyed this conversation, as always, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss the rest of our Instructional Coaching Done Well series. That's a mouthful. And again, if you are in Australia, don't forget to check out the Instructional Coaching Done Well Roadshow happening in different locations across June 2025. And details are available at growthcoaching.com.au.